I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's November 19th, and we have a lot to talk about. My guest today is Dr. Soha Sala. Dr. Sala is a research scientist at Kessler Foundation's Center for Mobility and Rehabilitation Engineering Research, and her studies involve looking at our brain and our behavior, specifically testing a person's ability to walk while performing a cognitive task, which is called dual tasking. Dual tasking is something that all of us do throughout our day, and it's something that's affected by MS. What's equally fascinating to me about Dr. Sala's work is the innovative approach that she takes to her research. We'll talk to Dr. Sala about her research into dual tasking and MS, and we'll talk about some of the innovations that she's introducing to MS research. But before we do, there are a few other things that you should know about, starting with a pretty big announcement about the podcast. Last week at the National MS Society's Leadership Conference, we announced a partnership between Real Talk MS and the National MS Society. This means that when people visit the National MS Society's website, they'll be able to connect to the Real Talk MS podcast, so we'll be extending our reach and expanding the Real Talk MS listener community. And I'll share with you three reasons why I'm so thrilled about this partnership. First, the National MS Society has invested $1 billion in MS research. They're the largest private funder of MS research in the world, and that's important to me because research drives our future. Second, the MS Society leads the way in providing amazing services to support families affected by MS. If you're a longtime listener, you've heard me rave about the MS Navigator program, which just continues to amaze me. The MS Navigators provide one-to-one individual problem-solving and support for people affected by MS, no matter what kind of a problem they may be facing. And their ability to take on difficult and complex situations, find resources, identify solutions, and get those problems turned around, well, I think it's just extraordinary. And then reason number three is advocacy, which is my other passion. The MS Society leads the way in making sure that our state and national elected representatives fully understand the legislative issues that are most important and most impactful to families affected by MS, like having access to quality, affordable health care, and having access to affordable prescription medications. So, all things considered, I couldn't be more proud to be partnering with the National Multiple Sclerosis Society and making it even easier for more people affected by MS to find the podcast. I'm a pretty big basketball fan, and I remember when NBA superstars LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh decided to combine their skills, and they went on to win championships with the Miami Heat. And I thought about this when I heard the announcement that the University of California, San Francisco, University of California, Berkeley, and the University of Washington are combining their skills to launch the Weill NeuroHub, an innovative research network that will accelerate neuroscience research by forging collaborations among experts in interdisciplinary fields, including artificial intelligence, engineering, and data science. And all of this is aimed at speeding the development of new therapies for diseases that affect the brain and the central nervous system. The Weill NeuroHub is being funded by a $106 million gift from the Weill Family Foundation. And beyond combining the extraordinary talents in each of these three academic institutions, the NeuroHub will also be able to draw on the expertise and resources of the 17 national laboratories overseen by the U.S. Department of Energy. Now, these laboratories excel in bioengineering, imaging, and data science, and the NeuroHub will be positioned to leverage the Department of Energy's artificial intelligence and supercomputing resources. Like LeBron, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh in the NBA, I've seen firsthand that science benefits from collaboration. It's what the International Progressive MS Alliance is all about. I've seen how the speed of scientific discovery is increased when we break down institutional barriers and allow the best and the brightest minds to focus their collective efforts on solving a problem. So I'm really excited about the potential for the Weill NeuroHub, and I'm looking forward to keeping you updated as this ambitious project moves forward. How many things that you need to purchase regularly have gone up in price more than 73% in just the past 6 years? The list of possible right answers to that question is probably pretty small. But if you answered Tecfidera, you'd be right. Tecfidera is an oral disease-modifying therapy for relapsing MS, and when Tecfidera received FDA approval in 2013, the yearly wholesale cost was $54,750. Today, the cost for the exact same drug is $94,991. And I'll take a minute here, because I want that to really sink in. Because there's no other word to describe that kind of a catastrophic price increase besides outrageous. And the reason that I'm talking about it today is that last week, I told you about the FDA approval for Vumerity, a new oral disease-modifying therapy from Biogen, the same pharmaceutical company that produces Tecfidera. And this week, we discovered that Vumerity is being priced at $88,000. And if I can paraphrase Barry Talenti, the Executive Vice President of Advocacy for the National MS Society, medications can change lives only if they're accessible. But when it comes to having access to MS disease-modifying therapy, the situation isn't as black and white as you might think. For instance, I know of someone living with MS who doesn't have health insurance. This individual contacted Genentech, the pharmaceutical company that produces Ocrevus, and they offered to provide Ocrevus to her at no cost, which is amazing. And by the way, this kind of a program is offered by every major pharmaceutical company. However, Ocrevus is administered by infusion, and this same individual ran into a financial roadblock when she couldn't find a hospital that would waive their infusion fee. So pharma wasn't the bad guy in this case. Yet the bottom line is that the person living with MS still doesn't have access to disease-modifying therapy. So the problem, and therefore the solution, can be more complex. Even people living with MS who have health insurance still face barriers to having access to their prescription medications. And those barriers might be related to which MS disease-modifying therapies are on their insurance company's list of approved drugs. And by the way, who creates those lists? Well, the person who creates those lists is known as a pharmacy benefit manager, and those folks have a major impact on which drugs are approved and how much you're going to pay for them. Yet most people have never even heard of pharmacy benefit managers, let alone understand what they actually do and how they go about doing it. Now, this isn't to say that pharmaceutical companies don't bear some responsibility in all of this, but I find it really difficult to try to fix anything until you really understand what it is you're trying to fix. And the first step to having access to affordable prescription medications is making this whole process much more transparent. Once we can see and understand all of the moving parts, well, then we can start talking about solutions that might actually improve the system and provide that access to prescription medications in a fair and equitable way. So, do we need access to affordable disease-modifying therapies? Well, the answer should be an obvious yes. But getting to yes isn't nearly as obvious as you might think. If you're living with MS, you're probably familiar with the EDSS, or Expanded Disability Status Scale. It's a scale that goes from 0 to 10, and it's used to quantify someone's level of MS-related disability. EDSS is also used to determine the success of a clinical trial for proposed MS therapies. Did the participant's EDSS score improve? But using an EDSS score to reflect MS-related disability has been criticized as being too heavily reliant on walking. Specifically, how well someone completes a timed 25-foot walk in their neurologist's office or clinic. And when you focus on ambulation, other important MS symptoms like cognition or fine motor skills are often overlooked. So last month, a research team representing the Multiple Sclerosis Outcome Assessments Consortium published a paper recommending a four-part assessment designed to provide a better overall assessment of an MS patient's actual status and the MS progression that they may be experiencing. Now, the four tests include a timed 25-foot walk for ambulation assessment, low-contrast letter acuity to assess vision, the symbol-digit modalities test to evaluate cognition, and the nine-hole peg test for manual dexterity and fine motor skills. The Multiple Sclerosis Outcomes Assessments Consortium tested this four-pronged, multidimensional test battery and found that the four tests combined to provide a more complete and more accurate picture of how MS was impacting an individual when compared with their EDSS score. And based on the results of their study, which involved data from more than 12,000 people living with MS, they've submitted applications to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and the European Medicines Agency for regulatory approval of these measures as the new benchmark to be used in MS clinical trials. And if this toolkit of tests is approved, it'll be freely available to MS research investigators. Now, if you'd like to learn more about this proposed MS assessment toolkit, I'll include a link to the results of the MS Outcome Assessments Consortium's research paper in today's show notes. And while we're talking about that timed 25-foot walk as the sole means of measuring MS disability, consider for a minute the conditions under which a neurologist asks someone to do that 25-foot walk. The patient doesn't have to think about anything else other than completing that walk as quickly and with the least amount of difficulty as possible. Now compare that to real life, because when you're walking, you're talking, or you're thinking, or you're looking at your phone, which I don't recommend, but I see it happen all the time. Walking 25 feet under those real-world conditions would probably produce a different result. And that's something that my guest, Dr. Soha Sala, is interested in. How does MS impact our real-world dual tasking? In a moment, we'll meet my guest, Dr. Soha Sala, a research scientist at Kessler Foundation's Center for Mobility and Rehabilitation Engineering Research. Dr. Soha Sala is a research scientist at Kessler Foundation's Center for Mobility and Rehabilitation Engineering Research. Her studies involve brain and behavior, testing a person's ability to walk while performing a cognitive task called dual tasking. Dr. Sala has found that brain-muscle connectivity is weaker in MS, and that connectivity correlates with slower walking speed and with slower speed of processing. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Sala.
Thank you.
You're doing some really interesting work, and although I gave a pretty brief explanation, I'm wondering if you can tell us what dual tasking is and how MS seems to impact dual tasking.
So dual tasking is to perform two tasks simultaneously. And this is part of everyday life. We don't do singles. Like for most of the times, we're doing dual tasks. Like we're talking while walking. We take notes during business meetings. You're driving, you avoid potholes, you pay attention to traffic lights. All this is a dual task. You're doing a motor task and a cognitive task simultaneously. And dual tasking usually cause a drop in performance in one of them, either cognition or motor or in both. And this is completely normal, and we call it a dual task cost. This is true for even healthy individuals. For example, you're walking, you get a phone call, you pick it up, you answer, and you continue walking, but eventually you'll slow down because you're engaged in a conversation. You're not walking as fast as you probably used to be. This is a dual task cost, and this is known to be safe, and it's not a problem. In MS, what we're afraid of is that a higher dual task cost can be significant and can actually affect the safety and the performance in daily living. If the dual task cost is significantly higher than healthy individuals, these people can be slower in daily life. They can be slower or unable to process information quick enough to avoid accidents. For example, if they are driving and if they can't process the information about unanticipated obstacle on the road, this can cause an accident. And that's why we want to study their behavior and how significant is the higher dual task cost in these individuals.
So as you're discovering this, how can people living with MS best offset that sort of deficit so that they remain safe?
At the beginning, actually, we're still at the stage of evaluating. And we're doing the evaluation mainly to understand the cause of that, the neurophysiological background or the mechanism, and the behavior. And what we plan to do is we learn more about it so we can establish or design better treatment. For the person of MS, mostly they're not aware there is such problem. And even in the literature, there is no consistent association between dual task cost and cognition, or there is no consistent findings of higher dual task cost in persons with MS because it was studied differently in different types of paradigms and also in different types of design. And because the persons with MS are mainly they're evaluated separately for cognition and movement. So probably I should explain this better because evaluation is important. So when they're evaluated in a research study or in the clinic, they're evaluated how fast they can walk or how good their gait is in a hallway. Okay, so they're just doing a motor task or in a gait lab or something. And when they're evaluated for cognition, they're evaluated using standard assessment of cognition, of information processing speed, of visual spatial memory, and so on working memory. But they're not doing a motor task during this cognitive evaluation. So they're being evaluated separately for two different tasks. But when they go out in the real world, they're using this cognitive processing and their movement processing, they're doing it together, and we're not evaluating them that way. And that's the risk, that we're missing something important here. In a sample that we studied in a paper we published in a journal last year, in 2018, we studied a sample of healthy control that was matched to persons with MS. They were evaluated for their walking speed and for cognition, and they were found to be matched. There's no difference. There was no difference in cognitive performance. In other words, there was absence of cognitive impairment in the sample of persons of MS we studied. However, when we studied dual task cost of walking performance and cognitive performance, we found that only the MS group showed higher dual task cost of cognitive performance, although the assessment showed that they were fine. They were as good as the healthy control participants. So what we're trying to say that these assessments, they're testing them separately, but then when they do the tasks together, they're not doing as good. And this needs to be further studied.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. You know, as I was reading some of the work that you've published, what stood out to me was how innovative your work really is. You use methodologies that haven't been used before, or perhaps haven't been used in that way before. For instance, your C-mill treadmill study. I understand it was the first study of internal brain connectivity and brain muscle connectivity, and it incorporated virtual reality and EEG cap. Can you tell us about how this study leveraged virtual reality, what an EEG cap is, and how using it allowed you to create an activation map?
Sure. Yeah. So I'll give you a background first of why we got to use virtual reality and EEG technology in this study. So in the previous study we did, that I just mentioned, that we found higher dual task cost in the MS group. We also found the neuroimaging main finding we found using FNIRS, functional near infrared spectroscopy, which is another mobile imaging technique. We found that those who showed a decline in cognitive performance, have a different pattern of cortical activation. So the MS group have higher activation in one of the brain regions, the supplementary motor area, during dual tasking, and that correlated with a worse motor and cognitive function. So with FNIRS, we studied only premotor regions. So that actually was the first study to use FNIRS that way, to look at premotor regions in MS. It was done before in healthy controls. But FNIRS has a big advantage, which is portability, but we are limited to study fewer brain regions. With EEG, the electroencephalography, the EEG cap can cover the whole brain. So we have 64-channel cap, so we can record whole brain activation. So then we designed this new study where we combined FNIRS and EEG in the same cap. So this is one of the innovative components of the study. So we have a cap with EEG electrodes 64, and we have FNIRS optical electrodes as well. We call them optodes that cover 20 channels in the brain that cover sensory and motor areas and parietal areas, and the EEG covers the whole brain. And because dual task is can be studied in different paradigms, we thought of using virtual reality, because one of the challenges in daily life is when you're walking and you get an obstacle that you need to avoid, and you need to avoid it quickly. And that cannot be tested in a regular lab setting. We cannot have a participant walk and we like just throw obstacles on their way. So with CML, we can do that. CML stands for Q Mill, like from treadmill. So it's an instrumented treadmill with force plates under, so we can assess gait as the participant walk. But also there are projectors on the front and on the side which can project obstacles or cues on the treadmill track. So instead of having or testing the participants in a dual task by asking them to talk while walking or subtracting some number, like the subtracting by seven task, we get them to walk, and then we in a part on a block of the experiment, in another block, we project obstacles and they have to avoid these obstacles and walk around them, like in real life, like you're walking and then you get some sudden unanticipated obstacle and you walk around it, and we record brain and muscle activation during that, and then we look at the brain activation. Also, we look at the communication between different brain regions. We call it within brain connectivity, and we look at also the signal from the brain to the muscles, and what we call brain muscle connectivity. And we see like how different is that in the healthy individuals and the MS group.
People that listen to my podcast pretty regularly know that I'm a little bit of a science nerd. And as you were explaining that particular project, my eyes just opened wider and wider. It sounds remarkable. What sort of things are you learning?
So when we collected the data, I personally learned a lot from the behavior of the participants on the treadmill, like how significant is the obstacle avoidance is, how hard it is for these participants. So because you see them walking like over the ground, and we mainly interact with them just during assessments or testing, we don't know exactly the challenges they have in daily life. But when I saw them in the treadmill, how hard it was for them to just how long it took them to actually wait for the cue, for the obstacle, and actually think, they took really long time, like sometimes like more than a second, to actually decide which way to go and then how to avoid that obstacle. So for each obstacle on the treadmill, it was a challenge for them to avoid it, and then it was, took some processing to walk around it. While healthy controls, I mean, you take this for granted. You just go continue going. And I think with that design, we were able to see how significant that is and how much it's important to study it in order to find treatment for it. Also, what was interesting is the lower brain-to-muscle connectivity, as you mentioned, but also we see that how it's related to walking speed. Like even in healthy controls, we have weaker connectivity that correlates with slower walking speed. The same weaker within-brain connectivity, more between the frontal brain regions and the more parietal brain regions, and the same, it correlates with weaker walking speed, so or a slower walking speed. So there is a relationship between how the brain is processing the task, which is in this case walking and avoiding obstacles, and their walking speed at least. Unfortunately, we don't have the data for their cognitive performance for that sample, but this is something we plan to collect and also look at that, how processing the obstacle avoidance, if it's related to the neuropsych assessments that we usually do in research studies.
What really makes this interesting and really important from my perspective is how this sort of research that can more closely mirror the kinds of things that people encounter every day in the real world, how this sort of research is ultimately going to translate into the kind of rehabilitation work so that people are better equipped and better prepared to navigate the real world. I mean, there's a real end user benefit here.
Yeah, so this is one of the goals of the lab, of myself, and then I collaborate closely with Dr. John DeLuca, and then at Kessler Foundation as well, and Dr. Brian Sandroff at University of Alabama. So we plan to continue investigating this. And also we plan to work on interventions that use virtual reality and that use cognitive training integrated with physical training to work on dual task cost in persons with MS. So this is what we are working on mainly for the future. At this stage, we were doing the assessments and diagnosis and trying to understand the neurophysiology and the performance, and eventually we'll transfer what we learned to more treatments or rehabilitation interventions to test their efficiency on performance.
Well, Dr. Soha Sala, I want to thank you for your contributions to this really groundbreaking research that not only helps us better understand the intersection of mobility and cognition, which taken separately look one way, but in the real world, we use them together, and it seems it's creating a very different picture of how that works, especially for people living with MS. But this work is also going to help people live better, because ultimately there will be rehabilitation treatment that's going to help them better manage that intersection of mobility and cognition as they're out in the world. So thank you for all the work that you're doing, and thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Well, that's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. If you haven't subscribed to the podcast, you might want to do that today. It's free, and that way you'll never miss an episode. You can find Real Talk MS wherever you find your favorite podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Pandora, or you can visit the Apple App Store or Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. And if you have an Amazon Echo or Echo Dot at home, well, you can just say, Alexa, enable the Real Talk MS podcast. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.